Hi, welcome to Focus Talk. Tension in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait area has been rising in recent months. Is the Chinese Communist Party making serious preparations of an invasion to Taiwan? What would be the consequence if the West cannot deter CCP's military aggression and expansion? Today, we invite Captain James Fennell to share his views on these issues. Captain Fennell is a former director of intelligence for the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet. Mr. Fennell had a nearly 30-year career as a naval intelligence officer specializing in Indo-Asia-Pacific security affairs. He's currently a fellow at Geneva Center for Security Policies. Captain Fennell, it's great to see you again.
It's great to see you, Jenny. Happy to be with you.
Great. So, in recent months, we have seen new levels of military aggression by the CCP in almost all of its peripheral areas, the Taiwan Strait, South China Sea, and the East China Sea. We see Chinese military aircrafts enter Taiwan's air defense identification zone almost daily. And then since March, there's this many Chinese fishing vessels gathered at the Whitsun Reef area. I think there's still over 40 remaining as we speak. And then Chinese vessels, entered the waters surrounding the Japanese-administered Senkaku Islands more frequently than ever. What do you make of this situation?
Well, it's very dangerous right now, Jenny. I think the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party are on a timeline to complete what they believe is their great rejuvenation of the People's Republic of China and consolidate all of their territory, the territory that they believe is part of their country. And I think they're combining this timeline that they've been working on along with testing the new administration in Washington. And so there's a confluence of working towards a goal to achieve this great rejuvenation and the great restoration of the territorial integrity of the People's Republic of China, along with testing a new regime. And this new regime in Washington are many people that were in the Obama administration and had been tested in the 2012 timeframe at Scarborough Shoal and in the Spratly Islands. And so I think it's a very dangerous time for the region as Beijing is seeking to advance their strategy and their timeline and consolidate their territory in these regions that you've mentioned.
So you're saying that Xi Jinping probably really see that the window of opportunity has come with the new U.S. administration?
I think it's very possible that Xi and the Chinese Communist Party planners and strategists that put together what they call their comprehensive national power planning effort have now calculated and recalculated from the Trump administration to a new administration to see whether or not that they can essentially bite off more territory right now than maybe they had planned to do maybe later in this, what I call the decade of concern from 2020 to 2030. And so they may now be able to move much earlier if they do not see a stiff resistance from the Biden administration.
So you're saying they're testing the Biden administration. If they feel the test is successful, they will make more moves, right? They will maybe push the boundary even further.
Yes, and it's not just the Biden administration. I think that's certainly the most dramatic shift in the last year besides the virus. So the combination of what's gone on around the world in response to the virus and how the free world has essentially locked themselves down in response to a virus that as of today, the U.S. Center for Disease Control says the number of hospitalizations in America's 3.4% are related to the COVID virus. So the idea that the United States is still essentially large parts of America are locked down, the economy is suppressed, industries are not working at maximum capacity because of a virus that's has minimal impact. Beijing sees that as an opportunity. And then when you have a change of administration, these are two great opportunities for Xi and the party to really move forward in a much more accelerated rate. And that's what's really worrisome, is they're seeing this kind of internal internal discord in America, and a lot of things that are that they never thought they'd probably see, and that's happening on a daily basis in the American domestic scene. And now, with the virus and the impacts on our economy and our productivity and our economic survivability, China now sees a window of opportunity that I think they didn't anticipate seeing until the end of the 2020s. And now it's been offered to them right up front.
Well, you just mentioned the 2012 Scarborough Shoal incident. I want to talk a bit more about it. It related to the Wisdom Reef situation that's happening right now. A lot of people criticized the Obama administration for failing to stop China in 2012 Scarborough Shoal standoff. Do you think a similar scenario is being played out here with the Wisdom Reef situation?
I think it's got a lot of similarities in the sense that China is moving into an area and essentially staking a claim to a piece of territory that had still been kind of ambiguous in terms of the Philippines, which is this Wisdom Reef, is inside the Republic of the Philippines exclusive economic zone. And so what you have is an area that China had not previously tested. But a little bit different now is because from 2012 to 2015 and beyond, China had built those seven islands. Mm-hmm. And essentially, they built two concentric circles, an inner circle and an outer circle. And the inner circle is where Wisdom Reef is. And so they're essentially now saying, we're going to occupy this area that we hadn't built a reef, but it's only 10 miles from Hughes Reef, which is one of the seven islands that they built. And they're essentially saying, we have in the past, since 2012 and then the 2016 permanent court of arbitration ruling, we have only kind of laid claim to those seven islands where we built up our forces. And now they're trying to say, it's not just 12 miles around each one of those areas. We're going to operate and occupy and claim everything inside the Spratlys and eventually the entire nine-dash line they believe is their territorial water. And when you say territorial water, by international law, you're suggesting 12 nautical miles of territorial water. So they're saying that everything in the South China Sea and the nine-dash line is as if it was 12 miles off the mainland of China.
Yeah, we saw that in 2012, after the Scarborough Shoal incident, the CCP has been building artificial islands, and they seem to been accelerating that effort since 2012. So now, this time, how do you think the U.S. should react? And if the U.S. does not respond strong enough, what would be the CCP's next move?
Well, I'll answer the latter portion of your question first, which is to say, if the United States fails to respond as they did in 2012, and I was witness to that from my position as the Director of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, and we failed to show any resolve and response to the PRC's actions at Scarborough. If we do that again, then what I previously described as China taking claim and staking claim to the entirety of the South China Sea will become a fait accompli, a de facto reality. And so I think it's very important that we, America, stands up and defends their treaty ally, the Philippines. And also, it's not just the Philippines, but it's every other country in ASEAN and Taiwan and Japan. They all have an interest in seeing the United States stand up for the international order, which says that a big country, which is what the Chinese call themselves, a big power, a big country, cannot dominate smaller countries just because they're powerful. That's not what the international order has been about. That's not what the United States has supported in World War II and the 70 or 80 years since World War II. And the United Nations Convention Law of the Sea, which the United States helped draft, we are the people that practice that on the oceans in the international waters. And we do not support big nations bullying small nations. And so it's really important that the United States steps up in this case, not just to help our treaty ally Philippines, but also to show support and resolve and commitment from the United States to all these other nations in the Indo-Asia Pacific region. So what should we do? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a number of things that we can do. And first is in the diplomatic arena. Our diplomats need to come out and speak very boldly and confidently that we will not stand for this kind of bullying from Beijing. That didn't happen in April to June of 2012. If you recall, during that Scarborough Shoal incident, the United States was quiet for those 4 or 5 months.
Yep.
And left a big hole in the world and in the region about what America's position was. So we need our diplomats to be much more aggressive and assertive. We just had an opportunity for that in Anchorage, and I think people are asking about whether or not this administration is going to do a better job of speaking out and speaking for those things. Now, I know Secretary of State Blinken has made some statements, and those are very good, but I think they need to be much, much stronger and much more routine. And it can't just be Secretary of State Blinken. It needs to be other members of the Biden administration, the Defense Department, the Defense Department spokesman. It should probably come from the White House as well, that the National Security Advisor or even the Vice President or President need to speak out against this bullying activity. So that's in the diplomatic arena. In the information arena, we're being outpaced by the PRC. The Chinese have a think tank called the South China Sea Probing Initiative, which is essentially works for the Chinese Communist Party to put out reports on a daily basis where they try to characterize U.S. military operations in the region. And they're painting this picture and they're promoting in their information and their press reporting that it's the United States that's militarized the South China Sea and the East China Sea. That's a lie.
Wow.
And everyone who lives out there in the region knows that's a lie, and they know that it's been the People's Republic of China that has militarized the region. Yet the United States doesn't have an adequate venue or a platform for articulating exactly what the PRC and the PLA Navy, the People's Armed Forces Maritime Militia, their fishing fleets are doing on a daily basis. Just this in the last 24 hours, we've seen reporting that the Chinese Navy, the PLA Navy, has sent Type 22 patrol craft, Hubei frigates, near Palawan to chase off Philippine press crews that are trying to report on Chinese activity.
This is
something that hasn't been countered by the U.S. So we need to do more in this information realm. Economically, the Trump tariffs and sanctions remain in place, and the Biden administration has kept those. So that's a very good thing. And we saw here in the last 24, 48 hours that the Biden administration has added 7 more companies to the entities list that are doing supercomputing. So that's a good sign from the Biden administration. I give them credit for that. And then the lastly is in the military arena.
Mm-hmm.
And what didn't happen at Scarborough in 2012 was using the U.S. military, naval forces, air forces, and other forces like special operations forces to insert themselves and to get in the way of what China is doing. So what's different about Whitsun Reef is that they're not actually building anything at this point. But the fact that they have those ships, now you said the latest report is around 40 of these ships still in this Whitsun Reef lagoon. That's, as I mentioned, is only 10 miles from Hughes Reef. The United States Navy and Air Forces should be steaming through that small 10-mile passage and transiting through there, maybe stopping and operating a number of ships, flying helicopters, turning on their radars, looking around, doing what they normally do because it's international water. And we should not cede any territorial waters or airspace to the PRC. And they're going to get upset about that. But I do not believe China is ready to start a war with the United States of America at this point. And if the United States were to do that, it would demonstrate to Japan and Australia and India, the members of the Quad, and other nations in the region, that the United States is not just speaking loud, not just putting out information, not just having economic sanctions, but is willing to put their people on the line to demonstrate to China that they cannot steal territory from the Republic of Philippines or any other nation in the region. And so I think it's across the board. It's what we call whole of government approach to dealing with China. And I think that's probably what we can give credit to the Trump administration for, which is to take this relationship with China out of this kind of stovepiped approach of, well, we deal with economics and separately from military issues, from diplomatic issues, or from information issues. We need to combine it all together and work towards a common goal. And that goal is to tell the People's Republic of China and Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party that you cannot just bully people because you're a big nation. That's not the way the world works, and we're not going to stand for it.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Chinese Navy versus U.S. Navy in a minute. But before that, I just want our audience to understand that this is not just about a few rocks or reefs. What would be the risks? What would be the consequence if the CCP takes control of South China Sea?
Right. So that's a great question. And many people ask this, what do we care about some rocks in the South China Sea? And it's not rocks, as you say. It is about the issue of, can a large country just pick and choose when they decide to control and give authorization for other nations to pass their ships through there? And as we know, in the South China Sea, $5 trillion worth of the world's economy passes through the South China Sea every year. Thousands of ships come from Europe to Asia and vice versa, and ships that come from Southeast Asia to America and to Australia. And so it's a global economy. And if we allow the Chinese to take possession of this huge, huge body of water, which is almost three or four times the size of the Mediterranean Sea, and to take control of it and to dictate who can come in and out, while right now they're talking about military vessels, who's to say that in 5 years it won't be commercial ships that don't do or comply with China's rules and regulations? We know right now China is very upset about the world focusing on their cotton production in Xinjiang. Well, what happens in 5 years if China owns the South China Sea and they get upset that somebody complains about cotton being harvested by slaves in Xinjiang, and they decide to embargo any commercial vessel that would come in or out of the South China Sea that's associated with a country or a company that has made these complaints? Mm-hmm. You can see the impact and the implication. It's almost economic hostage taking to the rest of the world. So it's important to establish and maintain the principles that we've had since the end of World War II and not allow China to usurp those international standards because they think they're big and powerful and they can do whatever they want. It's irrational.
Yeah, there are real consequences. So Captain Funnell, you had in-depth knowledge of the Chinese Navy during your 30 years career as a naval intelligence officer. Could you share some of the things you learned about the Chinese Navy, and how much do you think the Chinese Navy has progressed in recent years?
Well, Jenny, we're all watching right now this week that the Chinese sent their aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, with five ships total, including the first time with the Type 055 Renhai class cruiser, the Nanchang, together out through the Miyako Strait in the Ryukyu Islands and out into the Philippine Sea, and are now operating, as we're talking, operating just east of Taiwan. Concurrently, while the PLA Air Force and PLA Naval Air Forces are flying into the South China Sea, flying north of Taiwan. And so you have a pincer movement from the north and the south and from the east to the west, the Chinese military operating around Taiwan. And this naval carrier strike group, as we would call it, U.S. Navy, while it is still immature in some ways, because this Liaoning is a much smaller a size carrier than what the U.S. Navy has, the fact of the matter is the Chinese Navy has progressed in 20 years at a remarkable rate. They now have two operational aircraft carriers. They have two operational Renhai class cruisers, the Type 055, which is one of the most powerful cruisers in the world today. And they have plenty of destroyers, of the Luoyang 3 class, Chiang Kai 2 frigates, and submarines, both diesel and air independent propulsion, and nuclear submarines that are coming online. And so they've been on a 20-year trajectory of growth, not just in the number of ships and platforms that they have, but in their operational experience. And so they're actually right now, in this last couple of weeks, they've been operating in all three of their major fleet areas, in the North Sea Fleet, in the East China Sea, in the East Sea Fleet, and in the South China Sea, and as well as operating and conducting amphibious exercises in the Fujian province in the Taiwan Strait area. So China's military, and specifically their Navy, has grown in both quantitatively and qualitatively. And what's worrisome is that they continue to project growth, high growth rates for the PLA over the next 5 years. This year, they projected they're going to grow at 6.8%. Last year, it was 6.6%. Even in the year of the COVID, where there was low gross domestic product growth for all of China, the Chinese Communist Party said, while our overall economy won't grow that high, we're still going to put a lot of money into the military. Mm-hmm. And so I think people need to be aware that China is, as I mentioned earlier, they're on a plan, they have a timeline, and they're going to continue to build this military and make it more capable. And they're building it across submarines, ships, aircraft, strategic rocket force, cyber forces, strategic support forces, logistics forces, and amphibious forces, marine forces, airborne forces that can be parachuted in. Mm-hmm. They're doing all of this along with a civil-military fusion effort, which ties their civilian forces, their civilian commercial ships, their civilian aircraft into a relationship with the PLA that allows them on a day of decision to bring all their efforts to bear and what Mao would have called the people's war in order to achieve the objectives that they want, which is to take Taiwan and force Taiwan to become part of the People's Republic of China.
Yeah. Now, we all know that the CCP's main concern about invading Taiwan is that the U.S. would intervene. So I've talked to some Chinese military experts, and they said that the CCP has been vigorously working on its capabilities to counter U.S. intervention. And eventually, their goal is to drive the U.S. military out of the South China Sea area. What's your view on that?
Yeah, the Chinese call this the counter-intervention strategy. In America and in the West, we call it A2AD, or anti-access area denial. But it's the same concept generally, which is to say you're going to build missiles and platforms, bombers, fighters, warships, submarines that can project missiles that can strike U.S. forces outside of the first island chain and even outside of the second island chain in order to prevent U.S. forces from having free access inside those waters to be able to launch wave after wave of attack aircraft off their aircraft carriers, or to operate freely from bases like Guam or Okinawa, or to operate from bases in the Philippines, because of the Chinese missile threat, and not just missiles from mainland China, but missiles from their the ships that we've talked about that have long-range anti-ship cruise missiles, or even shore-based missiles that they have in the Taiwan Strait that can reach out 400 to 500 to 600 kilometers, that can cover the entire Taiwan Strait north and south. And so China's goal is to use those layers of forces from the air, forces from the surface, forces from under the surface to drive away the U.S. military. And there's been a great debate inside the U.S. About whether or not we could operate inside the first island chain or the second island chain over the last two decades. And what was revealed in January towards the end of the Trump administration was a strategic framework document that was published by the National Security Council. And it discussed in this 10-page document that had been classified and then declassified for release to the world, it talked about one of the strategic aims. And this document had been written in 2018 by the Trump administration, National Security Council. It talked about the priority of making sure that American military forces could operate inside the first island chain. So I think what your viewers should understand is that while it's still very, very dangerous for U.S. forces to operate inside the first island chain, that doesn't mean that they cannot operate inside the first island chain. And so they have been working on a number of techniques and systems and weapon systems that allow them that freedom of maneuver. It's still a very difficult area. But I think what's important is for people to understand that the American military is still trying to operate inside those regions, and they have plans and systems to enable them to do that.
Well, I think a lot of people are arguing that it's much more needed today than ever in order to constrain or deter CCP's military aggression. Now, another thing I want to check with you is, we just talked about the importance of South China Sea. I have talked to some other China analysts. They say that if the CCP controlled this area, their nuclear-powered submarine could enter the Pacific Ocean via some South China Sea passage, thus posing direct threat to U.S. mainland. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I think in the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, which was a great power competition like today, the Soviet Navy operated in areas that they called bastions, the Sea of Okhotsk in the Pacific, up in the Kola Peninsula, up in the Arctic on the North Fleet area. And these areas that they operated in, these bastions, were sanctuaries that the Soviets thought that their ballistic missile submarines could operate and still be able to launch nuclear missiles at the United States and have them be able to reach the United States without compromise, enabling essentially a first strike or a second strike capability. And so I think China has been is well aware of that bastion strategy, but they have lacked the capability to reach the United States, continental United States, from some of these bastions like the Bohai or the South China Sea, because of the range of the JL-2 intercontinental ballistic missile, which is part of the Jin-class ballistic missile submarines. But with the development of a JL-3 ballistic missile, which is a longer range, and a new generation of ballistic missile submarine, it's the type 096, it's possible that China could operate from the South China Sea and launch ballistic missiles and at least hit, obviously, Hawaii, but they could easily hit the west coast of the United States and increasingly more or half of the United States. Now, if they were able to get outside of the South China Sea and into the Pacific, say between the first and second island chains, that's another area that they could kind of create their own bastion area as well, which would give them essentially the ability to strike all of the United States. So having control of the South China Sea, it gives them a bastion there for their ballistic missile submarines. And as we know, the Chinese have their ballistic missile submarines, at least four of them, homeported on Hainan Island. And so this is an area that allows them to get into a deeper water of the South China Sea and have a modicum of self-defense down there with their own submarines, and the fact that they've got these seven islands and the controls that they have in the Paracels to the Spratlys. This allows them to have some control in their own minds of being able to put their ballistic missiles submarines to sea and then protect them and allow them to be used, not just against the United States, but they could also be used against India.
Yep. So containing CCP inside this first island chain, I think is critical, and it's very much relevant to the safety of U.S. and average Americans in this country. And we've also, so far we've heard warnings from everywhere that Beijing is accelerating its timeline for a possible invasion of Taiwan, just like you said at the very beginning. Some say in 6 years, some say in 2 to 3 years, and some say that the period after 2022 Winter Olympics and the CCP's 20th Party Congress will be the most dangerous time. So what are your thoughts in terms of this timeline?
Right. Admiral Davidson, the outgoing commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, in his testimony before Congress, did mention that within the 6 years, mm-hmm. and I was obviously very pleased to see him make that admission, because it aligns with what I've been speaking about for 10 years.
Yeah, you gave the warning way early, I remember, back in 2014.
Right, so the fact that the commander of Indo-Pacific Command, outgoing, and the incoming commander of Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral Aquilino, who I used to work for at Pacific Fleet, are talking like this, for me, since I know those gentlemen, it is a clear indicator to me that the situation is very, very serious. These are not people that are going to just say things off the cuff or say things, as some people have accused them of saying it, to drive the Navy's budget. That is a lie. I don't believe that for a second. I know them, and they would never say that. This is about real threat assessment, assessing the threat from the PRC. And when they say that, that should cause people to really wake up and pay attention. So the question that you asked is, there's people now talking about the best time frame would be after the
Olympics.
The Olympics and the National People's Congress would be a time. And the more that people talk about that, the more worried I get that China could do something before. I always go with the idea that, you know, expect the unexpected. And so if everyone is saying that China won't do anything until after a certain time frame, then you need to look between now and that time frame to see when is it possible that the PRC could make a move. And I guess the answer is we really don't know. But every indicator across all indicators suggests that they're getting very, very close to making a maneuver. Now, some people say, well, this just goes with classic Chinese psychological warfare, and they're trying to intimidate Taiwan into capitulating. And I don't doubt that for a minute, that the PRC would prefer that the folks on Taiwan would essentially say, okay, we're going to give up and go with a political solution rather than risk an invasion and a war. I think that's clearly an option of what Xi and the Communist Party are trying to do. But I don't doubt also that the PLA and other hardliners inside the command structure there in Beijing are arguing vociferously to say, this is the best time to go. Because if we wait, mm-hmm. if we wait until 2022, and for some reason the Republican Party comes back into power in the United States and takes control of the Congress, and Donald Trump or somebody associated with Donald Trump who's much more hardline, like, say, former Secretary of State Pompeo, were to come back into the White House and take a much more demonstrable hard line against China, they may not want to see that. And it may cause them to say, we can't afford to wait too much longer while the U.S. rearms itself and retools itself to be able to defeat the PRC's counter-intervention strategy. And so those arguments are going on right now. And I think this is really a very, very, as I said, this is a decade of concern. I thought originally that the decade would be more concerned at the end of the decade. But right now, I'm very concerned that China could decide to do something very soon.
Well, we're seeing U.S. and its allies, sending all kinds of signals to Beijing, right? So they're having these 2+2 meetings, conducting joint military exercises, and Germany is going to send a warship to the South China Sea in August. It's a little bit too late, I think. But are these enough to deter the CCP? Or what else do you think US and its allies should do to effectively deter CCP's military expansion and aggression?
Well, one of the things that we've seen, in addition to Germany and the United Kingdom is coming out with their carrier strike group, the Queen Elizabeth, here later in the summer or early summer, along with a ship from Holland as part of that group. So those are good signals. The French have just had an amphibious group come out, and French submarines are operating in the South China Sea. So we're seeing the European Union start to wake up and understand the concerns about what's happening, because they have an economic interest in this area that we talked about. It's in their economic interest to ensure the free access to markets that we've had for all these years. So that is a good sign. But if we take, if these countries in the EU take this approach like it was, like we have for the last two decades, then as you mentioned, it'll be too late. And so what can we do in the meantime or right now? And I think one of the areas is the Quad. And I think what we're seeing now with what happened with India along their line of actual control and the murder of 20 Indian soldiers last June, I think India has really had a transformation in their not understanding of the PRC, but their understanding of the imminency of the threat. And so I think in addition to the naval exercises that we can conduct in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea with these Quad nations, there are other operations that the U.S. and Japan and Australia could do with the Indian Army along the border in the Himalayas. And it's very touchy for the Indians, and I understand that. But also the idea that we would stretch Beijing's attention around their periphery and not just have it focused on the maritime domain is really important. And then that gets back to Russia and the northern border. And unfortunately, over the last several years, for some crazy reasons in U.S. domestic politics, we've essentially taken that tool off the table. And I think it's really important that we figure out a way to demonstrate to Russia that while it may be in the short term in their interest to have negotiation or not negotiations, but alliances with China, in their long term benefit, staying aligned with the People's Republic of China is not going to be in their interest if China gets too big. And so how do we bring Russia into that dynamic? Unfortunately, I'm afraid right now Russia's, looking at the Crimea and the Ukraine and taking territory there. And so we've missed an opportunity, and that's too bad. But as it relates to the rest of China's periphery, I think we need to do a lot more with India. Japan and the United States and Australia really need to demonstrate to India that they're willing to work with them and bring the Indians not only eastward into the areas that we're concerned about in the South China Sea, but we need to be willing to send our ground forces up to the line of control to work with the Indians, maybe work under Indian command, because they're the experts up there in high-altitude Himalayan ground warfare. And let us demonstrate to China that if you do something, you're going to have to deal with India in your southern underbelly. And then finally, I'd say, and this is an area that is very controversial. It was controversial. I think it's less controversial today, which is to say, what are we doing to present a clear and unambiguous threat to the People's Republic of China in terms of the ability of Taiwan and Japan and other nations and the United States to be able to strike the Chinese mainland, and not just with conventional weapons, but with other weapons. And that technology has been available. That technology had been deployed to places like South Korea and Japan and even Taiwan over the last 50 years. And we need to bring that back out of the dustbin of history, and we need to put it back out into the arena and to discuss this. And Beijing needs to understand that if they really try to do what they think they can do, that they will pay dearly for it, and that many, many Chinese could lose their lives over some kind of adventurism like this. China benefited for 80 years from the existing international order. They were able to raise their people, many people, out of poverty, as they tell us in their press releases. And that's a good thing. But it didn't come from acting like a bully. It came from accepting the international community system and living inside of that and benefiting from it. But if they want to disrupt that and take control of it and force people and make people slaves to them and bully them and intimidate them and force them to comply, that's not going to work. And if they invade Taiwan or try to invade Taiwan, then the Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party need to understand that they will pay a dear price for that.
Yeah, I think the Chinese Communist Party would only care when their regime is in danger. So if there's a way to make them realize that they may lose power, that their regime, the Communist Party, may collapse out of this, if they do this, then I think they will have a second thought. So my last question is that, do you think the Biden administration would give up the traditional so-called strategic ambiguous policy, instead make it clear, you know, have an unambiguous policy, make it clear that the U.S. will come to Taiwan's defense if the CCP invade Taiwan? Do you think the Biden administration would go that route?
There's a lot of bipartisan pressure right now in Washington, people from the left and the right, that are saying it's time to end the policy of strategic ambiguity regarding Taiwan. And I've been a strong supporter of that over the years, and I hope that the Biden administration does it. I had wished that it had been done during the Obama administration, when it would have meant so much more in terms of real military balance of power. But the old saying is there's no time like the present. And so I think they should do it. I hope they will do it, and that's all I'll say right now.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Captain Fennell, for offering your insights and experience. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
It's been my honor, and I really do hope that the United States and the people of Taiwan and the region can demonstrate to China that they must not do this, because it will be a calamity not only for the regime, but it'll be a calamity for the world.
Exactly. Thank you, Captain Fennell. Talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, everyone, for watching Focus Talk. We'll see you next time.